At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool, but financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back for another episode of my mystery series, where today we have a story with a bit of a twist. We're not so much going to be talking about a single crime today, but instead a theory as to why crime happens, particularly why crime is so prevalent throughout the mid to late 1900s. It's a well-known fact that the 1970s in particular seemed to be a prime time for serial killers, and we've pondered in many videos on my channel why that is, why serial killers are so much rarer now than they used to be. A lot of people put it down to the increase in surveillance and forensic technology nowadays, meaning there's just less opportunity. But what if that wasn't the reason at all? What if the reason was exposure to lead? The lead crime hypothesis posits that childhood exposure to toxic lead was and is a major cause of criminal behaviour and general violence in adulthood. And today we're going to explore that. So, the lead paint theory. Obviously, this is just a theory and nothing about this has ever been confirmed. I'm not even sure how possible it is to fully confirm a theory like this is correct. But it is an idea that's been passing through academic circles for a while and was brought into public view in 2013 in an article on Mother Jones by Kevin Drum entitled Lead, America's Real Criminal Element. And from there, it's really caught a lot of popularity in public circles. The general idea behind this theory starts around the early 1960s, when America started to see a huge increase in levels of violent crime that continued increasing until it hit a peak in the early 1990s, so 30 years later. After that point in the 90s, violent crime started to decline rapidly, and despite what a lot of the media would have you believe, it does continue to decline today. At the peak, you were looking at around 750 violent crimes per 100,000 people around 1993-1994 at its peak. Now I do want to point out that those numbers do come out of the USA, as does most of the information surrounding this theory, but the theory can be applied to the UK as well and other countries around the world. There's just less research around it in other places, or at least that I could find on the internet anyway. So if I am referring to the USA in this episode more than other places, that'd be why. Please don't get offended, my Americans, I'm not saying you're more violent. According to Drum's article from Mother Jones, in New York State alone, between 1960 and the early 1990s, rape rates had nearly quadrupled, murder had quintupled, and robbery had grown 14-fold. People were scared, and cities across the USA were seeing similar increases. Then it suddenly seemed to stop. A paper called The Lead Crime Hypothesis, a Meta-Analysis by Anthony Higney, Nick Hanley and Mirko Moro from February 2021 writes that in the USA alone, the homicide rate has halved since the 1980s, and although this fall hasn't been as great in other countries, the drop has still been very noticeable. Over the past couple of decades, people have come up with plenty of explanations as to why there was this sudden drop in violent crimes in the mid-90s, and politicians at the time were, of course, very quick to take credit for this drop, saying it was their policies that led to it. Rudy Giuliani ran for mayor of New York City at this time in the mid-90s, and one of his biggest campaign points was bringing down crime, something he knew was going to be a huge job. Jerome writes in his article that Giuliani followed a crime theory called broken windows, in which it basically says if one window in a building is broken and left unrepaired, all the other windows would soon be broken as well. It was to do with tolerance. If you were seen to be being tolerant to a small crime or small indiscretion, that would lead to larger crimes taking place. The idea was that cracking down on the smaller crimes would eventually mean these bigger crimes would stop happening as well, and that was going to be Giuliani's focus. And when Giuliani won his election, he did make his attempt to crack down on crime. He put a brand new NYPD commissioner in place who really did focus on these smaller things, like stopping fare dodgers or turnstile jumpers on the subway, going after drunks, stopping squeegee men, who are people who wipe windshields and stop cars in traffic in exchange for money. They usually just do it without permission and expect payments. These were very small things the new commissioner focused on, small crimes, but that was the focus in the hope that bigger crime would stop as well. And strangely enough, it did seem to stop. By 1996, the New York Times was reporting a drop in crime numbers for the third year in a row. Rape rates dropped 17%, assault 27%, robbery 42%, and murder 49%. Giuliani, of course, took credit for all of this. And by 2010, violent crime in New York City had dropped 75%. But strangely enough, at this same time in the 90s, crime wasn't just dropping in NYC. Crime rates were dropping across the whole country. Could a mayor being elected in New York City really make that much of a difference countrywide? It seems unlikely, but it looked like that was what was happening. Drum again writes that Washington DC's violent crime dropped by 58%. Dallas by 70% and Los Angeles by a whopping 78%. Sorry, I am going to be referring back to Drum's article a lot in this video. It was kind of just the first and most comprehensive source on this theory, and any other articles about this all stem from this first one. I will of course link it down below in case anybody wants to go have a read. It's super interesting, so I really would recommend. But do we think it's likely that one man being elected in New York City led to a drop in crime across the whole country and the Western world in general? Probably not. So people started to come up with other theories. There's one controversial theory called the Donoghue-Levitt hypothesis from 2001 that refers to the effect of legalised abortion on crime, which is very apt to mention now that Roe v. Wade has very sadly been overturned. This hypothesis suggests that crime reduced in the decades following the legalisation of abortion as increased availability of abortion led to fewer births of children at the highest risk of committing crime later in life. A 1966 study out of Sweden suggested that children born to women who had been denied an abortion turned out to be registered more often with psychiatric services, engaged in more antisocial and criminal behaviour, and to be more dependent on public assistance. The thinking behind this theory is fairly simple. Abortion demographics tend to lean towards women who are young, unmarried, and poor. Children born to mothers who aren't prepared for motherhood, whether they're too young, uneducated, living in poverty, unsupported, are at a higher risk for committing crime as adults simply due to the circumstances of their upbringings. And that's not to say that every child who's a result of an unwanted pregnancy will go on to become a criminal, of course, but according to this hypothesis, evidence suggests that it is more likely that there is a correlation. Roe v. Wade, a landmark decision of the US Supreme Court that ruled that the US Constitution protects a pregnant woman's right to choose to have an abortion, came into place in 1973. It was noted by Donoghue and Levitt that around 18 years after this, in the early 90s, that's when murder rates started to fall. They also noted that the five states that legalised abortion earlier than 1973, so you've got New York, California, Washington, Hawaii and Alaska, started to show a decline in crime earlier than the early 90s, and that the states with especially high abortion rates in the 70s and 80s had dramatic crime reductions in the 1990s. It's a very interesting theory for sure, although it is controversial, and there has been a lot of evidence to dispute it as well, such as the fact that the crime rate actually seems to drop first amongst older people. Most crime is committed by males between the ages of 17 and 25, which means that if abortion was connected to crime rates, the numbers should have dropped first amongst younger people. But instead, nearly 60% of the decline in murder since 1990 involved people 25 and older, people who had been born before Roe v. Wade. There's also the fact that other nations with high abortion rates had a large increase in crime about 18 years after legalising abortion. Britain legalised abortion in 1968, but violent crime actually rose from 1985 to 2000 before beginning to decline again. I think around 2007 it started to decline. Russia had one of the highest abortion rates in the world, but instead had a huge increase of crime following the breakup of the Soviet Union. That again has started to decline since the 2000s. We can probably come up with some good theories as to why crime increased after the breakup of the Soviet Union, but it doesn't seem to have any correlation with abortion.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Then there's also the fact that crime rates rise and fall constantly, whilst abortion rates are relatively constant. If they're correlated, wouldn't you expect them to remain the same for the most part? So although the abortion theory has been looked into a lot over the years, there are still plenty of things to go against it. I suppose now with the repeal of Roe v. Wade, we'll be able to see if there are any fluctuations in crime rates in 18 years' time, particularly in the states that have already started to repeal the abortion rights. Perhaps one day I will do a full video about Roe v. Wade when my anger over the situation has subsided, but that's not going to be right now. But if not abortions, what could be another cause of the drop in crime in the 90s? Well, there's also the thought that it could be a reflection of the crack epidemic of the 80s. There was a real issue with crack cocaine throughout the USA in the 80s particularly, and this was focused mainly in the big cities. And of course, it makes sense that an increased drug use would come hand in hand with increased crime, including obviously violent crime. And this is all tied in with gang violence a lot of the time as well. But how exactly did the crack epidemic of the 80s potentially lead to a drop in crime in the 90s? The data around this is incomplete. There's not a huge amount of data out there about this epidemic because by its nature, drug taking is a secretive act. But one of the prevailing thoughts is that the children of the crack addicts of the 80s turned to softer drugs in the 90s, mostly marijuana. Seeing the havoc drugs wreaked on their parents, or just seeing the effects that the crack epidemics had on the country, less people wanted that lifestyle for themselves. As I said, this is just a theory, of course, but less hard drugs could very much equal less crime. People are less desperate and less likely to commit crimes either to get drugs or as a result of being on drugs. Some sources say that the Donoghue-Levitt abortion study confirms that the crime rate rose and fell most significantly exactly where crack cocaine was most easily available or likely to be used, in large cities and amongst young black males. Whilst other sources say that the fact crime fell across the country as a whole and not just in these cities suggests that something else entirely might have been responsible. And that something may well be the focus of today's episode, lead. And this theory is particularly interesting because not only does it potentially explain the peak and then the drop in crime from the 90s onwards, but also the amount of crime in the 70s. It could explain the sheer amount of serial killers, which is something I've pondered about on my channel for many years. I've wondered on my channel if head injuries could be the reason for the serial killer peak in the 70s, people not realising the repercussions of a concussion or a bad bump to the head. There were simply less scans and less medical tech available to detect and treat brain injuries when they happened, and damaged frontal cortexes could lead to a lack of impulse control and a proclivity towards violence in adult life. We've spoken about how serial killers of the 70s were born and raised in the aftermath of World War II by parents, fathers, suffering with PTSD and a range of other undiagnosed and untreated mental illnesses, possibly making these parents more inclined towards violence towards their own children, raising violent adults. a general lack of love, care, and nurturing as a child may very well lead to uncaring, unloving adults. I've delved into all of that more times than I can count, but we've never discussed the possibility of lead poisoning, which actually seems to be a stronger theory than anything else I've mentioned in this video. Lead in its natural form is a dense heavy metal that is easily extracted from its ores, and as a result there's evidence that's been used by humans since prehistoric time. Lead was used heavily in ancient Rome, although the production of lead declined after the fall in Rome and didn't reach the same levels again until the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. It was always a very helpful metal to have on hand. It's got high density, a low melting point, and doesn't really oxidise. The fact that it's also very easy to get a hold of means that it has a low cost, and so naturally humans have used it for whatever they could over the years. Construction, plumbing, bullets, weights, batteries, radiation shielding, paints, gasoline. The use of lead were never ending. However, what a lot of humanity failed to realise for far too many years is that lead is also a neurotoxin, a poison that acts on the nervous system. Some people have known this for a very long time. It was well recorded that a lot of Roman workers died after exposure to lead, and one Roman architect and engineer called Vitruvius noted that water conducted through earthen pipes is more wholesome than through lead. This may be verified by observing the workers in lead, who are of a pallid colour. So people did know, they've known throughout history, but they either chose to ignore it or just didn't think it was that serious. Lead poisoning occurs when lead enters the body. In most cases, it's very small amounts of lead consumed over time that eventually build up and cause some very serious problems, especially in children. According to the NHS, the symptoms of lead poisoning in children can include irritability and fatigue, loss of appetite and weight loss, abdominal pain, vomiting, constipation, hearing loss, and developmental delay and learning difficulties. Children generally tend to absorb more lead than adults thanks to the fact their bones and organs are still growing. However, adults aren't free of risk either. They can get symptoms including high blood pressure, abdominal pain, constipation, joint and muscle pain, pain, numbness and tingling of the extremities, headaches, fatigue, memory loss, and miscarriage or premature birth in pregnant women. Newborns who are exposed to lead in the uterus might have had lower weight and slowed growth. In the UK today, we're at a very, very small risk of lead poisoning. Pretty much the only lead left is lead water pipes, but even they are fairly rare. If your house was built before 1970, then there is a small chance the pipe that connects your property to the water main in the street is made of lead, but if that's found to be the case, it will be removed. Now, these are all fairly generic symptoms that could point to many different illnesses, but the good news is that there is treatment for lead poisoning if you find yourself suffering. The first of which is just removing the source of contamination, which could be anything from the lead water pipes just mentioned to lead paint being used. If you're found to have high levels of lead in your system, then there is a drug that can be taken orally, or if you've got very high levels, there is a course of injections that you can get. Correlation between lead poisoning and illness in humans has been noted for many years, since the early 90s at the very latest. In 1994, a man called Rick Nevin was working as a consultant for the US Department of Housing and Urban Development. His main job was looking at the costs and benefits of removing lead paint from old houses, which was following a growing amount of research linking lead exposure in childhood with complications in later life, including lower IQ, hyperactivity, behavioural problems, and learning disabilities. But then a client suggested to Nevin that he might be missing something after they read a recent study that made a link between childhood lead exposure and juvenile delinquency. Could lead exposure really have a link to violent crime? And Nevin was intrigued, so this became his focus going forward. He soon found that whilst lead paint was indeed a problem in children's homes, literally surrounding them as they grew up, he found that the biggest source of lead in the previous decades was from leaded gasoline. From after the war, so in the early 40s, through to the early 70s, lead emissions from cars quadrupled. And then as unleaded gas started to become more popular, that number started to decline again. Interestingly, as my YouTube viewers will be able to see on screen right now, the graph of violent crime rates follows that exact same pattern, just 20 or so years delayed. The dangerous molecule in leaded gasoline or leaded petrol, depending on where you are in the world, is tetraethyl lead, and it was known, or should have been known, to be not so safe from the very early days of use. Tetraethyl lead was invented by a company called General Motors as a gasoline additive to generally help gas perform better, to help the cars move faster or the gasoline to go further. I don't know, I don't like cars. But scientists were immediately concerned by this and urged the government to properly investigate the implications of tetraethyl lead on public health. But of course, that didn't really happen. General Motors did fund a government bureau to conduct some research into this, but they sneakily added a clause into the contract saying that they had to approve the findings at the end. So of course, the bureau's report was published, reporting nothing adverse, and tetraethyl lead was free for use in petrol nationwide. This was all in the early 20s, but the general public still wasn't entirely sold. So in October 1924, a press conference was held where a chemist called Thomas Midgley washed his hands in a container of tetraethyl lead, proclaiming that it must be safe if he was willing to do that. What he didn't share with the public, though, is that he'd only just recovered from a bout of lead poisoning himself. And back at the factory where the product was being produced, workers were getting sick and dying. The lab where it was developed was literally known as the Loony Gas Building, due to the fact that the workers there seemed to lose their minds. Regardless, it was still deemed safe to use in gasoline and was pumped out into the atmosphere, with Midgley saying, "The average street will probably be so free from lead that it will be impossible to detect or its absorption." Although no actual experiments had been done to judge whether or not this was true, he was just saying it. So yeah, they all knew that tetraethyl lead wasn't all that great, but in a plot twist, it turns out they also knew of something else that could have been added to petrol that would have had the same positive effects, and that was ethyl alcohol. Ethyl alcohol was proven to be safe unless you consumed large amounts of this, and Midgley knew this. It was also easier to make and more accessible, so why didn't they use that instead? Well, for those exact reasons. If anyone can make it, you can't make all that much money on it. Capitalism is the reason here, as it always is. Tetraethyl lead could be patented, whilst ethyl alcohol couldn't really be. In a year 2000 paper written by Rick Nevin, this connection was all made and all explored, but was ultimately ignored by the scientific community. Kevin Drum writes in his article for Mother Jones, in a 2000 paper he concluded that if you add a lag time of 23 years, lead emissions from automobiles explain 90% of the variation in violent crime in America. So toddlers who ingested high levels of lead in the 40s and 50s really were more likely, it seemed, to become violent criminals in the 60s, 70s and 80s. But like I said, Nevin's paper didn't make any huge waves in the scientific community, probably because it was published in Environmental Research, which isn't really something criminologists would tend to keep a track of. At the same time as this though, a graduate student at Harvard called Jessica Walpole-Reyes had also had her interest piqued by lead levels after attending a talk by Levitt where he outlined his abortion crime hypothesis. She decided to write her own paper with a focus on lead instead of abortion. After months of research, she managed to get hold of lead emissions data at state levels, not the country as a whole, individual states. Although the levels of violent crime and the levels of lead emissions did seem to follow the same curve countrywide, there was every chance this could have been pure coincidence, caused by any number of things. But Reyes knew that if she could get the historic data at state levels, she could compare state by state to see if there were any anomalies. She managed to get hold of the data, and there weren't any anomalies. In each state, the curve of violent crime and the use of leaded gasoline and leaded petrol followed each other almost perfectly. When states would slowly phase out the use of leaded gasoline, the crime levels would slowly drop a couple of decades later. When they suddenly banned it, crime levels would decline quickly. It was fascinating. Here in Britain, leaded petrol was banned in 1986. The violent crime rate here peaked in 2007 before dropping sharply, 21 years later. Jump forward a few years to 2007. Nevin had continued with his research and he published a new paper looking at crime trends around the whole world, seeing if there were similar correlations in other countries. If there were, this was further proof that his theory was correct, surely. Well, data for Australia, Canada, Britain, Finland, France, Italy, New Zealand and West Germany all followed the exact same pattern as the USA. The curve of lead use and violent crime followed each other perfectly. In fact, Nevin has never found a country that doesn't match. In more recent years, more and more scientists have started to take note of this, and more specific data has been looked at. For example, in 2013, a researcher with Tulane University, Howard Mielke, published a paper looking at the correlation between lead and crime on city levels. They studied six cities in the USA and found that they all followed the same graph. But not only that, in some cases they even looked down to neighbourhood levels, looking at neighbourhoods with high levels of crime, and sure enough, found that they had more exposure to lead 20 years earlier. This evidence seemed pretty irrefutable. So basically, lead is introduced into the atmosphere from the tailpipes of cars, the amount of which is rising steadily but rapidly in the aftermath of World War II. The children born around this time would have become teenagers in the 60s, late 60s, with each new year more teenagers being subject to lead their whole lives, becoming adults. As we've already touched on, lead poisoning had a variety of neurological symptoms alongside the physical. Research over the years has found links to aggression, a lack of impulse control, ADHD, and a lower IQ, which are the same links you'll often find in young violent offenders, particularly in males. You'll see a lot of these same symptoms when you look at damage to the frontal cortexes of the brain, and it's proven that lead poisoning in infancy, even at very low levels, impairs the development of the parts of the brain that regulate behaviour and mood. That's the anterior cingulate cortex and prefrontal cortex. In a lot of serial killer cases, we've spoken about how potential head injuries could lead to damage of the prefrontal cortexes, which could lead to this kind of irregular behaviour later in life. But what if it isn't head injuries at all that's causing it? What if it was lead poisoning? Could lead poisoning really cause the kind of sociopathy that we see in so many of the serial killers of the 70s? Well, probably not, because otherwise there would have been even more serial killers, I'm sure. But perhaps it didn't help. Perhaps this was just one ingredient in the amalgamation of things that led to killers throughout the 1970s. Killers like the Zodiac, John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy, Son of Sam, the Hillside Strangler, the Golden State Killer, Jeffrey Dahmer if we're looking more into the 80s. And that's just to name a few, I could keep going. Can you name as many serial killers in the 90s through to the 2000s? Of course, I'm not saying they didn't exist, they 100% existed, but evidence suggests there were less serial killers in this time, less violent crime in general. Obviously, not every child born from the 1940s through to the 1970s became violent as a result of lead everywhere. If lead had this same effect on every person, then the violence would have been uncontrollable.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
But perhaps it had more of an effect on some than others. Perhaps some were more susceptible. Boys certainly were more susceptible, that's fact. A study by Aharoni et al. From 2013 suggested after brain scans that prisoners with lower activity in the anterior cingulate cortex are twice as likely to reoffend once they've been released. One of the main effects, as we've covered, of childhood lead poisoning is permanent loss of tissue in the anterior cingulate cortex that controls emotional regulation, impulse control, attention, mental flexibility, and more. A 2017 study by Isa and Curry looked at children in Rhode Island, tracking the effects of lead on individuals instead of on the population as a whole. They looked at behaviour in schools, suspensions, detentions, etc., along with childhood blood lead levels and the distance these children lived from major roadways. They found correlation. In 2016, Feigenbaum and Miller looked at cities in the early 20th century that installed lead pipes versus iron water pipes. 2 decades later, the cities with lead pipes had murder rates 14 to 36% higher than the iron pipe cities. Also in 2017, Billings and Shepnell looked at two groups of 2-year-olds born in North Carolina in the 1990s. Both groups had high levels of lead poisoning, one group slightly above 10 milligrams of lead in their blood and the other less. The high group received intervention that lowered their exposure to lead, and later in life, they had far lower arrests for violent crime. I could keep going all day. There are so many studies in this just in the last decade. And I can't go through this video without mentioning the disproportionate effect that lead poisoning had on minority communities. Black people in the USA were more likely to be struggling, living in inner city areas in unrenovated housing with peeling lead paint and next to busy roads where cars are constantly releasing lead from their exhausts. Black people were always found, still are in certain areas, to have higher average levels of lead poisoning than white Americans. A study from 1986 found that 18% of white children had over 20 milligrams per deciliter of lead in their blood, compared with 52% of black children. Another study between 1976 and 1980 found that black infants were 8 times more likely to be carrying over 40 milligrams, which is a huge, life-changing amount of lead, in their blood. That is enough to make you seriously ill. This could explain so much about the differences in crime rates between black and white Americans throughout the 70s and 80s. Levels of crime committed by black men increased exponentially, much more than it did for white men in this time. But since 1991, violent crimes committed by black juveniles dropped sharply. An article in the Washington Post by Kevin Humphreys from 2016 notes that the rate of imprisonment amongst black men has dropped 22% since the year 2000, as opposed to white men who are seeing a 4% higher incarceration rate. The racial disparity has shrunk by nearly a quarter because of this. Incarceration rates for black women dropped 47%. Some theories of this are the change in drug use and drug enforcement since the 90s, or the fact that sex offenders are disproportionately white and there's been a huge focus on getting people for sexual offences. But less lead being used could also be a huge factor at play as well. Even as late as 2007 to 2010, black children still had disproportionately elevated levels of lead in their blood, something the media and the justice system in general fails to recognise. A large amount of black people still live in poverty and old housing in the same areas they did decades ago. For a lot of people and communities, this hasn't changed. This is a cycle of racism, class divides, less opportunities for black people to get out of these poverty-stricken areas that comes back around in this cycle, more arrests, more crimes. But whilst lead might lend a hand to all of this, the heart of this blame can lie on racism, this cycle being impossible for most to break out of. Also really interestingly, the Mother Jones article talks about how rich people have moved into gentrified neighbourhoods since the 90s and have immediately renovated everything, stripping back the paint in these houses, taking the house back down to the boards, releasing all of that lead from the 40s, 50s, 60s onto their children. I don't know if that could directly correlate with the increase in white prisoners, but perhaps it could. Lead poisoning is a problem that can affect everyone, it doesn't discriminate. So if you are moving into an old house, particularly one built in the 40s, 50s, 60s, get things tested before you start tearing it down. Although lead did stop being used in general household and car products many decades ago now, it's still hanging around. It's thought that there are around 16 million homes with lead-painted windows in the US. That would cost $10 billion per year for 20 years to replace. It was around the 1970s that people started to realise the side effects of lead poisoning, and unleaded gasoline started to become more commonplace, as well as lead being taken out of your normal everyday things. Leaded paint was a huge thing, as well as leaded pipes. The water you drink literally travelling through leaded pipes to your tap. Slowly, all of these things were phased out, and by the end of the 1980s, leaded gasoline was pretty much gone. It was banned in 1996, but by that point, you could barely find it anywhere anyway. It started to be phased out in the early 1970s. 2 decades later, in the early 90s, you see the crime levels begin to fall as the children born then become adults and for some reason don't turn violent. And of course, there are those who completely dismiss the lead crime theory, and as I said earlier, none of this is proven. How do you prove something like this? It is just a theory. A study published around 2016 in the Journal of Quantitative Criminology suggested that the correlation between lead and crime might not exist at all, as the entire theory might be based on faulty crime data. The lead crime theory follows the FBI's Uniform Crime Report, and even the study admits if you look at just that, the correlation is undeniable. However, this study argues that the Uniform Crime Report is unreliable and undercounts crime levels, particularly undercounting rape and aggravated assault. If you look at other data sources, like the National Crime Victimisation Survey and homicide numbers, there doesn't seem to be much of a correlation between crime and lead at all. And apparently the National Crime Victimisation Survey is thought to be more reliable, as it does more closely correlate with the homicide rate, where the Uniform Crime Rate does not. However, this is only on a national level. They didn't look more specifically into local or city crime. Is that enough to dismiss the theory entirely? I don't think so, but it is certainly something to bear in mind. Other people say that the drop in crime is down to something as simple as the increase in both forensic technology and surveillance. Criminals simply aren't as brave when they know there's an increased chance of them getting caught. Perhaps that could explain drops in crime nowadays, but in the early 90s, I'm not too sure. Forensic technology was still very much in its infancy at this time, although it was on its way, and surveillance cameras weren't as commonplace as they are nowadays. It certainly could explain away part of the drop though, and they do say that the best way to avoid having your home broken into is by having a Ring camera nowadays. Surveillance, who is stupid enough to risk that? But back to lead. This is still an issue today, mostly because of the aforementioned houses lined with lead paint on their walls and windows, but also just because of the sheer amount of lead that was let out into our world in the 40s to the 70s. The lead that came out of the car exhaust had to go somewhere and settled in our ground, in our soil. The same soil in which our food is grown that we walk out in every day. And studies have shown that exposure to even just this soil can cause blood lead levels to increase in children, sometimes enough to do serious damage still. How do you clear that up? How do you clear up all the soil in the world? Well, it's difficult and costs a lot of money to do so, costing anywhere from $2 to $36 per square foot. Same as the windows, it could cost as much as $10 billion per year to clean up just America. But remember, this is a problem worldwide.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If this money was invested in a soil cleanup though, and the lead crime theory is correct, this could come back to thank us in 20 years' time with less violent crime and less money having to be spent on incarceration. More productivity, higher IQs, smarter people means a better economy. Will the USA do it though? Probably not. The prison system is a business. I don't think they particularly want less prisoners, but that's a whole video for another time. Cleaning up the soil could be a very high-risk, high-reward kind of scenario if they did do it. The Biden administration is currently pushing for $45 billion to remove all lead pipes and service lines in the country, although I don't think they're going to get all that money to do so. They said this estimated that drinking water can make up 20% or more of a person's total exposure to lead. Infants who consume formula mixed with tap water can receive 40 to 60% of their exposure through tap water. Changing out the lead pipes could have a really positive effect on people's children's health. But what's the cost-benefit analysis of changing it all? They simply won't know this for a couple of decades. Some argue that it's not worth the price of changing all the lead pipes, that enough people aren't affected. But crime alone causes about $1 trillion of damage per year. Can you even fathom that amount of money? Although the numbers I'm sharing are American, it's worth noting this logic can be applied to countries all around the world. Pretty much everywhere, every country has issues with lead poisoning. If I had to place my bets, I would say that I do think there's a correlation between crime and lead, but even if there's not, I think cleaning up the decades of lead can only do good for society as a whole. One leading expert says that data suggests that lead could account for as much as 90% of the change in crime rate during the 20th century. But even if it's not linked to violent crime, maybe it is worth fixing just for the health of our children. It is hard to separate lead poisoning from other things that could have had an effect on crime rates. Things like poorer schools, bad nutrition, a lack of medical care, other pollutants, just poor parenting. Sometimes there's even just a natural genetic predisposition towards crime. Until you can remove all of these other variables, we'll never be able to get a solid answer as to the lead crime hypothesis. But you can't really remove these other variables. And you also can't start deliberately poisoning children to test this theory. So a theory, it hopefully shall remain. Thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. I really hope you guys found this one as interesting as I did. This is probably one of the most interesting things I've researched in months. I really, really found it fascinating looking into this. So I hope that you guys found it as fascinating as I did. And thank you so much for watching. I'll see you in the next one. Bye, guys.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.